How long did you want to talk, Gabe?
Hell, I'll talk as long as you'll give me. An hour, hour and a half would be, I think, more than sufficient.
Okay.
So.
Alright, so maybe we can do an hour, alright?
Hmm?
Maybe we can do it in an hour, do you think?
Yeah, we'll give it a shot.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. I'm doing an interview, but it's not for broadcast, so if you need to interrupt me, and I'll take calls. Use your judgment on calls.
Marvin Miller told me that you and Whitey Ford were two of the first guys who believed that the Players Association could do a lot for players. What convinced you early? Or what did you believe they could do?
Well, I knew the Players Association that existed when I joined the Major League wasn't doing very much. So any change was likely to be good. At that time, we were represented by Judge Cannon, who I didn't really think was as sharp as a lot of the other players thought he was. And so when the group that was looking for an executive director, Robin Robertson, that group, Bob Friend, and they came up with Marvin Miller, I knew right away, I mean, he had to be better than Judge Cannon. This was before I met him. So then once I had a chance to meet Marvin and hear him, I realized he would be a tremendous benefit to the players because he would educate them. He was a teacher. Really, he was a teacher. He was a very good teacher. And also, we could tell from the reaction of the owners that Marvin would be good for us. They hated him. He was saying that he would bring in goons and bicycle chains and baseball bats, and there would be violence and strikes and picket signs and violence on the picket lines, and we didn't need that in our union. And of course, we all realized that we did need that. That that would be better than what we had.
They thought he was going to be Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, well, with a minimum salary of $7,000, I mean, anything looked good to us. Even the, even Teamsters, even Jimmy Hoffa would have been better than what we had. But the owners really missed the boat. They had a chance to. Most of the players did not want a union. They didn't even want to call it a union. That's why they call it a Players Association. They hated the word union. Most ball players are very conservative guys. They grew up on small towns, in families where their daddies told them that the unions were the bad guys, and the unions were communist and, you know, Bolshevik and all that other stuff. So most ball players wanted to just play ball. They didn't want to have anything to do with a union. You talked about unions in the clubhouse. You were called the clubhouse lawyer. That's the nickname you would pick up. So the owners could have really made a wonderful offer to the players. The players would have thought it was wonderful. They would cut it. If the owners had said to us in 1966 and 65, when we wanted to raise the minimum salary from $7,000 to $10,000 or $12,000, whatever it was, if the owners had said to us, not only will we raise the minimum from 7 to 10, but we'll raise it $1,000 a year for the next 20 years, and we'll double the meal money. Every player would have gone for it immediately. That would have been enough. They wouldn't have cared whether the pension plan was funded or not, because a lot of guys didn't even understand what that meant. They would have just said, hey, minimum salary, $1,000 a year, double the meal money, we'll take it. The owners were so greedy, they wouldn't even offer us that. And because of that incredible greed, we hired Marvin Miller. Marvin educated the players, and then we ended up getting far more than we would have been willing to accept in the beginning.
Leonard Coppa told me almost the same thing. He said, in those first 10 years, if the owners had given the players what they wanted at any time, the union would have been irrelevant.
Exactly. Who told you that?
Leonard Coppa.
Yeah. Yeah. If the union had offered the players just anything halfway decent, the players would have said, we'll take it. Because they wanted to play ball. They didn't want to negotiate. They didn't want to bargain or haggle or learn all this stuff, do a lot of reading. They didn't want to bother with it.
Why did it take players so long to start sharing salary information? Why did they
basically, dumb. Mostly dumb. Pretty dumb, really. All
ego.
Players were.
Ego.
Huh? It didn't have anything to do with ego, I don't think. The players believed that the owners had their best interest at heart. They really believed that. And when the owner said to Moose Gower, "Now, Moose, you know, we're giving you a special deal, Moose. Don't tell anybody else." Moose really believed that. So he didn't tell anybody else in the clubhouse that he was making $14,000 or $18,000 or whatever the absurd number was. And most of the guys would believe that. I was the first, Phil Lenz and I think were the first two Yankee players who said, "This is ridiculous. What are you making, Phil?" "Well, yeah, here's what I'm making." We agreed to tell each other's salaries. Tommy Tresh and I and Pepitone and Lenz agreed to, we would always share salary information because if one of us could make a breakthrough, then the others could capitalize on it. And it would make us wiser. We would have more information. So, but the other guys just kept their mouth shut. The only salary figures that they made public were Mickey Mouse. Because they could, you know, give him a check that was 11 feet long, and it would get pictured in the newspaper about this huge check that Dan Topin was giving Mickey Mouse for $100,000, and they'd tell Moose Cowan to keep quiet about the 21 he was getting.
Yeah. You were probably one of the few players who campaigned to be a player rep.
Yeah, this was... Yeah, I was more militant, obviously, than the other players on the team. And I wanted to, get in there and fight for the things I felt we were entitled to. But at that stage of the game, it was still a popularity contest. It would never occur to ball players in the 1960s that maybe the least popular guy on the team might make a good player representative, and it would be in their interest to have him on there. That you really, you know, that it isn't a popularity contest who the player representative. You should really put the smartest guy should be the player rep, or the guy who wants it the most, and who cares about it, who knows about it.
Of course, the guy you lost out to on the Yankees was a good man, Steve Hamilton.
Hamilton was a good player rep. He was. But the guy I ran against was Cleve Boyer. Who was more of a company guy. And so, you're right, Steve was a better choice than either one of us. Steve actually turned out to be a better player rep than I would have been because he combined the knowledge and the intelligence that I would have brought to it. And he had more interpersonal skills than I did. And he was able to communicate better with the players. So Steve Hamilton was actually the right choice.
I'm going to meet him in about 2 weeks.
You'll like him.
Yes, I've talked to him on the phone, and I do already.
You'll like him.
We have a mutual friend in Bill Guilfoyle.
Yeah, everybody likes Steve.
Mm-hmm.
So I was too outspoken and, you know, too much of a smartass to really be, you know, a pop guy.
Why are athletes so hostile toward intellectuals?
I think that not all of them, but most of them spend most of their time playing their sport. And so they become sort of like idiot savants. And that's their specialty, and anything else sort of scares them. I would say it's probably true for, you know, computer nerds who feel very uncomfortable and hostile toward people that they don't understand. It's a matter of incredible specialization. Whether you're a gymnast or a baseball player or playing in a symphony orchestra or something like that, if you spend all of your life perfecting a skill, yes, you're going to be maybe one of the best in the world at it, but you might not be able to tie your shoelaces or get to work in the morning. So that's what we have here with baseball players. There's a lot of guys who are really good at something but not good at all at other things. And suspicious of the things that they're not familiar with.
Of course, there were fewer college men in your generation
yes.
of players,
yeah,
too.
That's another reason, too. There were more and more kids were signing directly out of high school and going right into baseball, whereas today, colleges have replaced the lower minor leagues as a training ground, and so you've got most players today have been exposed to some college experience. When I was playing ball back in the late 50s and early 60s, guys who would read a book on the bus would get nicknamed professor or something like that. Hey, you're reading a book. Today, I imagine most of the guys would pick up a book very easily.
When you were working on Vault 4 and being surreptitious and all that, did you feel sometimes that your writer's allegiance to the truth was more important than your own self-interest?
Oh yes. And it wasn't a writer's allegiance in the sense that I felt I was part of a writing fraternity. I just felt that I really wanted to share with fans the way it really was. And so in order to tell the way it really was, I needed to show everything, including the warts, and including my own, you know, good and bad side. So I didn't try to edit the book, particularly when I was at the early stages of writing my notes and talking them into the tape recorder. I didn't do any editing. I basically said, well, I'll edit it later. Right now, I don't want to make any judgment about what's going to go in and what's going to be out. I'm just going to put it in.
What percentage of the material stayed in? I mean, how much more?
I would say that there was 10 times as much material out as in. There's huge stacks of paper, double-spaced. So only a small fraction got in, and even that we had to struggle to get down to 400 pages, because otherwise it would have been a 500-page book, and the publisher didn't want more than...
That's chock full as it is.
400 pages, jammed with stuff, and we had to throw out anecdotes and stories that were... we thought were pretty good, but it just was not.
Are those ever going to be collected?
No, I don't think so. I don't want to come out with Ball 4 outtakes. But the people have asked me about that. I've mined that book enough.
Does it seem pretty tame to you in retrospect?
Tame in terms of controversy, yes. But I think what makes the book hold up over the years is the fact that it was a carefully kept diary, and the players are very revealing of themselves, and since they were very unique and funny and interesting people, the book is funny and interesting, not because of me, but because of the players that made it that way. I mean, mm-hmm. if an Aztec Indian had kept a diary of life in the, you know, in Mexico in the early days, that would be just as interesting to read today as at any time. I mean, any time somebody keeps a diary of an experience, the diary stands as it's almost like reading a rock formation for a geologist, you know what I mean?
Sure.
It doesn't have to be current. It doesn't have to be controversial. All it has to do is be accurate for its time.
I'm a diarist. I've averaged over 1,000 words a day for about 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
I live in Las Vegas, and I just pour gambling stories in there all mm-hmm. the time. So I know exactly what you mean. It has a cathartic...
Yes. It is. It gives you a chance to see your own life and perspective as well as everything else.
Were you surprised by what you discovered about yourself that year?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think I learned some things on the spot. It was like almost on-the-job training. I was able to, each night I could report my teammates' reactions to me that day, and I was able to examine them and almost modify and change. For example, I started getting along with people I could never normally get along with, like Fred Talbot, for example. Fred and I never really, we were just like from two different worlds. And he's from the old school, you know, blood and guts, and tough guy, and I was, I started to see him in a different light. I used to just see him as a ball player, sort of a rough mouth ball player. Now I saw him as an interesting character for the book, because all those rough things that he was saying, I saw as great material. So now I started to cultivate him as a friend, and he ended up he ended up, to me, becoming, I just felt really close to Fred Talbot. I was very disappointed that he didn't like the book and that he doesn't want to speak to me after that. I was disappointed about that, so he's going back to his original feelings about me. But I think during that season, he actually had some good feelings about me.
Did you realize them?
Yeah, otherwise he wouldn't have said to me, for example, when I was recommending a restaurant to Steve Holman, Fred Talbot says, if Boughton, hey, Holman, if Boughton recommends a restaurant, you can be pretty sure they get some good communist dishes. I mean, he never would have addressed me personally like that.
He wouldn't
that.
Have taken the trouble
he
to
would
razz
have
you.
Taken the trouble to razz me, exactly. Or one time it was raining and we were all jumping into taxi cabs, and as the cab filled up, the next one would pull up, and I was just about to step into a cab, and Talbot jumps in ahead of me, and he slams the door, he rolls down the window, he says, take the next cab, you communist. But he became a very funny guy. And I started to see another side of Fred Talbot, and I really started to like him.
Do most or all pitchers fight what I think of as the time bomb in their arms? Is there a fail-safe point beyond which most pitchers expect their arm is going to...
No, you never know. You know, when you're throwing the ball hard and, you know, getting people out and you've just come up and you're feeling strong, I mean, you just feel like you'll do that forever. Yeah, everybody, I'm sure, feels like they're going to definitely be in the Hall of Fame. And like when I won 21 games my second year, I figured I'll win about 20 every year for like 10, 15 years. And then, you know, you just think you're invincible. You just think it'll go on forever. And you can't understand how other guys can have bad years. It doesn't make any sense to you. And then you get hurt. And then you realize, uh-oh. Then you experience for the first time that it's like being wounded in the jungle, like being a wounded animal in the jungle. You now have to get by on your wits, and the life expectancy is not too long. How long does a limping antelope make it? You know what I mean? You get picked right out of the herd, and you're gone. And that's what happens. You walk out to the mound, and if everything's not right, they're alive. You can't hide.
And you never really had any security after your arm went the first time, did you?
No. Oh, no, we never had any security when I played. There were no long-term contracts. Anybody was making peanuts. There were no guarantees or anything. And yet you couldn't save yourself. You couldn't go out there and say, I'm not going to throw this ball as hard as I could possibly throw it because I want to save a little in my arm. As soon as you let up a little bit, they started hitting you, and then you get sent down for another reason. You weren't getting hitters out. You know, couldn't say, hey, I'm saving myself for next week or next year, or hey, I'd like to have a 10-year career, so I'm not going to throw as hard tonight. You know, replace you immediately with some guy who's willing to give everything he had for that one last ball game. And I wasn't a big guy. I mean, I always felt like I was a Volkswagen in the Indianapolis 500, you know. Finely tuned Volkswagen. As long as everything was working perfectly, the motor, the carburetor, everything was just perfect, the tires, I could be in the race. But the minute a little something went wrong, boom, I had to go to the infield because I was a Volkswagen.
I like that. Reading ball four.
A Beetle.
No less.
Yeah. Right, a VW Beetle.
Not even
with
a VW
piece,
bus.
A VW Beetle with a peace sign on it. I'm trying. I mean, you realize how well-tuned that car has to be to stay in the Indianapolis 500? Boy.
Reading ball four, it seems to me that by then your competitive urges were almost internalized rather than directed toward getting opponents out. It was a battle within yourself to make the most of what you still had.
Oh yeah, and particularly the pitch I threw at that time was a knuckleball. And that's not the kind of pitch where you where it's a battle between you and the batter. That's if you got a good fastball or a curveball, you're out there battling the batter. When you're a knuckleball pitcher, you're battling yourself. You're battling the pitch itself. Because if you can throw the pitch properly, it gets the batter out. It takes care of everything. And it is out of your control once it leaves your hand.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it's you have to have the mind of a Zen Buddhist. from the fingertips of the safe cracker to throw a knuckleball. Because you have to throw a ball with your fingertip without any rotation. And the purpose of that is to make it jump around so crazily that it makes it hard to throw a strike. So a successful pitch is difficult to throw accurately.
You've been throwing it now for 40 years.
Now,
have you mastered it yet?
No, you never master it. You go through periods of time where you think you've mastered it, and then you walk out there one day and you realize it has gone on a vacation and neglected to tell you that it was going to be going on vacation. So some nights it just isn't there. And it all has to do with the delicacy of releasing this pitch at just the right point. The release point has to be perfect. The fingers have to be strong enough, but not too strong. And if you just turn it the slightest little way wrong, it tumbles and goes straight. And the knuckleball going straight is a triple. It's a line. It's a home run. It's not just a hard ground ball somewhere that maybe somebody will catch. It's a blast. But it's a batting practice speed. So it's very difficult. You wrestle with it, but it was the only pitch that I was able to stay in the big leagues with. It kept me in the big leagues. It enabled me to make a comeback in 78 at the age of 39, and enabled me to pitch at the age of 53 in a league of 22-year-olds. So, I mean, I love the pitch.
Was that comeback in 78 worth it?
Oh, yeah. It was a wonderful experience. Yeah, it was great. And not just getting back up to the Braves either, but seeing the minor leagues from a different perspective at a different age was...
You'd made a grand tour of the minors by then, right?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, well, it actually took me 2 years of minor league play to get back to the major league level. First year, 1977, I started out in Knoxville, Tennessee, then Durango, Mexico, then Portland, Oregon for one summer. I was 4-15 that summer. And then the next summer, I went to spring training with the Braves, and couldn't make any of the teams because they had too many players. Then I went and pitched batting practice for Richmond. So the Braves played an exhibition game against their AAA team. I pitched for Richmond against the Major League Braves, and I did very well. I left the game with a 3-1 lead. I struck out 7 guys in 7 innings. So they gave me a contract to play at Savannah. I went down to Savannah and won 13 games in 6 weeks and got called up to Atlanta. So I really earned my way back to the big leagues. It was not some of these celebrity walk-ons where a guy comes back and gets the pitch right away in the big leagues.
Does it bother you that it knocked your winning percentage under 500?
Nah.
I know Mantle has the regrets that he's hung around long enough to see his
average go
up.
No.
Just happy to be there, right?
I had my World Series wins in the world. I got 2 World Series wins.
Yeah, well, I remember you vividly.
2-1, so.
Yeah. Let's talk about 68 and 69, since that is the main focus of what I'm writing about. The holdout and boycott, you weren't quite involved in that because you'd signed as a minor leaguer with Seattle.
Yeah.
So you were already under contract.
I had signed my contract before they had decided to hold out. They had signed from the year before, as I remember it.
Right. And at the start of the book, you mentioned that you were obligated to report, but they couldn't find you an apartment, so that was your way of not reporting. What do you remember about that meeting at the Biltmore? The 125 players attended.
I don't have too many memories of that. It just seemed like the players were ready to do something finally. And I just was hoping that they could hold everybody together that wasn't at the meeting. Easy enough to get 120 guys fired up, but then they got to go out and convince 600, another 500 to feel the same way about it.
Was it tougher on the expansion team since everybody there was scrambling for a job?
Yeah, you had marginal guys and guys at the end of their careers. And kids coming up and just getting a chance for the first time, didn't want to get a black mark on their name. That's why I respected Lou Piniella for not showing up. He was just looking for his shot.
And he'd already gotten the short straw from three or four franchises.
Yeah, exactly. So it took a lot of guts for him to...
Yeah, I'd like to get to talk to him. I haven't been able to get a hold of him yet. What do you think would have happened if the owners had hardlined it and refused to give in? Do you think the players would have stuck together, or do you think
they would have started
dribbling into camp?
I think the players would have stuck together. I think they would have. One of the great things about Marvin Miller is that he understood the strengths and the weaknesses of his group. And I don't think he was ready to allow the players to have the strike if he didn't think that they would stick together. Substantial numbers. See, what the players have on their side, if they will just stick together, is that the owners really have an indefensible position. It's just not defensible for them to ask their employees to give up rights that all other American employees have in the interest of competitive balance, because it's absurd. There never was competitive balance in baseball under the Yankees when they won 29 pennants in 43 years, or 40 something like that.
Yeah.
There never was competitive balance, so the argument of competitive balance was absurd. You didn't need competitive balance to have a successful team, to have a successful business. And the other thing is, so what if a team went bankrupt? Everybody thinks, well, that would be the end of baseball. No, it wouldn't. It would just be the end of the owner of that particular team. Because you would walk into a bankruptcy court. I mean, whenever I play this out with somebody and say, if a team goes bankrupt, then baseball's all through. I said, no, it isn't. Here's what happens. A guy goes into court and says, I can't pay my bills, and I want to declare bankruptcy. And the judge says, well, you have assets here. You have a franchise. You have a logo. You have a name. You have a contract with a stadium. You've got player contracts. You have a lot of assets. You have to sell your assets for whatever you can get them for, and then use that to pay the bills. And most teams are worth more than their outstanding bills. So while a team may be losing money in terms of current income over expenses, the value of the franchise is always worth far more than the outstanding bills. So even if an owner is losing $500,000 a year every single year, and let's say he even owes $1 million, let's say he owes $2 million, let's say he's the worst baseball manager in the world and he owes $40 million.
Charlie Finley.
His franchise is still worth $90 million. In other words, his team will always be worth more than all his than 10 years of unpaid bills. So a judge would require him to simply sell his assets. The assets would then go to pay off these debts, and the new guy would own the team. But the Pittsburgh Pirates would be out there again the next year, because the new guy would then own the logo, the franchise, the team, and everything else. So what happens is that if a team would go bankrupt, the only person hurt is the owner of that particular team, not the whole game of baseball, and not the other owners.
Right. Finley proved that when he tried to run his team into the ground, and he still made a profit.
Sure. Right. So they really do have an indefensible position, and whenever anybody, when the writers are honest about it, then the owners start to lose their support, and they eventually cave in because they can't even justify it to their own business community. I'm sure other people in their business cronies at the club say, run this by me again? Why do you need to hold these guys' salaries down? What do you need? 6 years of service before they could become free agents? How's that again? You know? Why do you need a draft again? Doesn't make any sense.
Did you testify at Curt Flood's trial?
No.
No?
No, I testified at the Andy Messersmith arbitration hearing.
Okay. What was that like?
That was interesting. I was only there for the part that for my testimony, and I was the only former player called to testify. And they wanted somebody to testify to the owner's treatment of the players in the past. And so I used Ball 4 as my source, I quoted some passages from Brad Ford, some things that owners have told me in the past, Brad Powell, Corey Haney, Dan Topping. And this was accepted by the arbitrator as evidence, as legal evidence, because it's based on contemporaneous notes. See, I had contemporaneous notes as to treatment that I had received by general managers. You know, the threatening things they say to you, if you don't like this contract, well, you can quit baseball and stuff like that. And that was, you know, important for the arbitrator to hear that. See, my feeling always has been with Boyle Ford that the reason the owners didn't like the book had nothing to do with locker room secrets. It had to do with the fact that Boyle Ford was the first book to tell people how difficult it was to make a living in baseball. And the owners didn't want everybody to know that they were abusing their antitrust exemption. They didn't want people to know that they were taking advantage of the players, and Boyle Ford detailed all of that. They were afraid that a judge, a jury, an arbitrator, a congressman would read the book and decide that the owners were being unfair to the players. And ironically, that's exactly what happened. And 5 years later at the Messersmith hearing in 75, an arbitrator, partially based on Boyle Ford, but all the other factors taken into consideration, decided that the owners were taking advantage of their contracts, that they really weren't perpetuity contracts, they were really all one-year contracts. That's when the owners were forced to sit down with the players and negotiate a compromise, on 6 years, with an arbitrator to determine the salary between the years 2 through 6.
What was your reaction to Flood's lawsuit? Do you think this guy is nuts to sacrifice himself? Or
no, I just thought it was a very noble venture by Kurt Flood's part. And I had hoped that he had put enough money away in the years that he was playing to tide him over with sacrificing his career. What was he, about 31 years old?
32, yeah.
32, so he had probably another 5 years to go that he gave up.
Right, he sure did, too.
See, I think the Kurt Flood ruling, even though it went against the players, was framed in such a way that it led to the arbitrator. That was also part of what I think encouraged the arbitrator to decide that these were one-year contracts, not perpetuity contracts. So to that extent, the modern player owes a lot to Kurt Flood, and they should have given the guy what his salary would have been as a bonus, as a gift, just
in perpetuity.
Right, exactly. Here, we're going to give you if you had played the last 5 years instead of sacrificed yourself for the good of players, you would have made $500,000. So here's the $500,000 plus interest that you would have made, and just consider it a gift from us. Happy birthday.
he said in the hierarchy of living things, a ball player is like poultry. As far as the owners are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
One of the, when I wrote to you, I mentioned that Ball Ford raised my consciousness about baseball. And one perspective that I point out to people, which I derive from that, although it should be obvious, but few people think of it, is that ball players are at the top of their profession. I use a bell curve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people think a guy who hits 220 mm-hmm. or a guy who has a 4.5 ERA is a lousy ball player because he's on the left side of the curve of all major leaguers, forgetting that on the curve of all people who try to play the game or play it professionally, you're all on the right edge.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's something that most people don't understand. But the justification for players getting paid a lot of money is not the fact that they are among the 600 in the world at what they do. Justification is that they are part of a monopoly industry that earns X number of dollars, and they're entitled to their share of the money that comes into that industry. We all, the American system is that you get paid according to your economic contribution, not your social good or anything else. And players' economic contribution is pretty clear. So they're just, arguing for their share of the benefits. I always say to people, well, yeah, this guy looks like a bum at 210, but he's really more skilled than he appears to be. because baseball, like any sport, at any given time, if you took a snapshot, a third of the players would be having a good year, a third would be having a fair year, a third would be having a bad year. Because you can't do something in sports that's good, it's not bad for somebody else. Everybody does something well at somebody else's expense.
Right. Particularly in baseball.
Directly. Particularly in baseball. So that it's like taking 600 nuclear physicists, putting them in a college science class and grading them on a curve. It doesn't matter how hard they study or how smart they are. A third are going to do well, a third are going to do fair, and a third are going to flunk out. But people can go to a ballpark and boo a ball player for hitting 210, but they would never think of going to a theater and booing Steve Lawrence just because he's not as good a singer as Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, you know, and a dozen other singers that you could name. Or people go to the ballet and they never boo a ballet dancer, even though he's not as good as Bujonis or Baryshnikov or...
Even if he falls down.
Whatever. Even if they don't. And they always have roses there, no matter what. I say to my wife, wait a minute. Don't they ever have a bad night? Isn't there some night when they don't bring out the roses? I mean, they must have an off night once in a while.
I saw a pianist in London in a recital stop dead in the middle of a piece and apologize and walk off stage. And the audience sat there for 20 minutes
and couldn't figure it out
until he composed himself and came back. Came back out and finished the piece. Mm-hmm. And then he got the roses.
Right. And they probably didn't even know why he left.
Right.
He was at such a level that they couldn't understand it. But, people don't understand that about ball players. The guy in right field who just dropped the ball, he's the best player that ever played ball in Wake Cross, Georgia. You know what I mean? He's the best guy they ever had in Jablib, Wisconsin.
Jablib, huh? Remember that? Who was from Jablib? That was in the book.
Somebody.
Is that Gene Brabender country?
I don't know. Black Earth, Wisconsin.
Black Earth. Did you ever dream back in 66 and 67 that the minimum salary would exceed your outlandish hope of $20,000 a year?
No, isn't that funny? It turned out to be, I said $25,000
and you were a communist.
Right, for Christ's sake. You're always trying to be a wise guy. I was serious, you know, I tried to explain to the guys that they all had PhDs in hitting and pitching. And with a PhD at the top of his field, and the industry that makes money should be doing better than $10,000. They just didn't get it. No, that was them. They thought I was being a wise guy when they said 25,000. Turned out I was low.
Yeah, and not too long after. That was Marvin Miller.
Yeah.
Let me talk about the bullpen. I'm also writing a novel set in the bullpen.
Oh, yes?
Yes.
Well, Bo Grabowski is going to do your whole book for you.
Right. Well, after I turn the tape off, I'll tell you the background of it, because you'll get a kick out of it. But I have this notion of the guys in the bullpen, like the smart Alex in the back of the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not front and center where they can keep a close eye on you.
Yeah, and that was important,
is that right?
Too. That was important. Hey, get out and... duck back in there, they can see you from the dug. And if you were in the Astrodome, you had to watch out for Judge Hoffman's in the skybox. He would look down at you from the skybox, where the camera was on you. The red light is on. If you could see way out there, the red light was on, you knew it was in the bullpen, and you had to, you know, shape up, or whatever it is you were doing, you had to stop doing it.
How close attention can you pay to the game when you're out in the bullpen? It depends on the park, probably, right?
It depends on the park, but mostly after a while you start talking about other things. It's nice to be away from baseball for a while. Particularly early in the game when if it's a blowout one way or another and relievers aren't really going to be part of it, talk about other things. What's in the newspaper, you know, current events. Once in a while.
More intellectuals in the bullpen?
Once in a while.
Per capita?
Well, there's more intellectuals among pitchers than there are any other positions. It's a thinking man's position because it's a it's the position that initiates the action, so it requires some contemplation and some thought. Whereas the batter mostly just reacts to the thrown ball. So that's a reactive type of mind. It's a different kind of mind. I think most of the thinkers in baseball have been pitchers. Most of the books have been written by pitchers, right?
Mm-hmm. Starting with Jim Brosnan.
Right.
In fact, looking over my list of the player reps, top heavy in relief pitchers and catchers.
Yeah. So it's partly that. It's partly the fact that they're probably smarter, but also I think the fact that they've got the time. You know, you're sitting around a lot. You're not in the game every night. Even if you're a starting pitcher, you're still, you know, you have three nights off. If you're a bullpen pitcher, you have plenty of them. I mean, that's one of the things that made ball four possible. They had plenty of time to sit back and think about it and watch. And Brosnan, too. We were both playing third base every day. We would have missed most of what was going on. In the dugout, we would have been paying attention to the game, and we would have never known what was going on in the bullpen. Whereas a bullpen pitcher knows what's going on in the bullpen, can wander down, he's in the dugout for part of the game, then you're out like then you're in the clubhouse early. I mean, there's so many things. You almost have the free run of the place as a bullpen pitcher.
Do you prefer it? The starting?
No, I like the knowing that I was going into the game. I like starting better.
Let's see.
I was glad I was relieving when I was writing the book, though. I was glad it was a relief book.
What's the difference in, probably an obvious question, psychologically, or what was the difference between playing on that losing team in Seattle and playing on the first Yankee teams to be losers? Did shock set in on the Yankees when they realized how bad they had become?
Yeah, it was actually much tougher with the Yankees because it was a totally new experience for everybody. None of the guys had ever played on a loser. Some of them had never played on a loser in their life. But they've been winners in high school and college and the minors, and that's how they got to the big leagues. When they got to the big leagues, boom, they were the Yankees.
Like you.
Yeah. only I was different because I was a bench warmer in high school. I didn't really get to play that much. So I didn't come with the tradition of having been a winner at every level along the way. But most of the guys did. And so it was a tremendous shock. And we were trying to place blame for an athlete does. He cannot accept the fact that his skills have deteriorated, or he didn't somehow. It can't be an athlete's fault. An athlete always wants to blame somebody, preferably an umpire, because they're neutral. If you can't blame the umpire, you can blame an umpire for an at-bat or a bad game, but you can't really blame an umpire for a bad year. You can blame a group of umpires. For a scapegoat of that magnitude, you have to go into the manager's office. So usually it's the manager, and in this case, we picked Johnny Keene. He was the reason why we played so badly. When they got rid of Johnny Keene, Ralph Houk came back, and we still played badly.
Like worse.
And worse. And then we realized, hey, it isn't Johnny Keene or Ralph Houk, it's probably us. But see, with the Seattle Pilots, both of those guys, we weren't expected to win. We were an expansion team. And it was almost like it's like the Dirty Dozen, that we were picked because we weren't wanted somewhere else. So that, nobody expected anything out of us, and if they got anything, it was a bonus. So the only expectations anybody had for us were the unrealistic expectations of our owners. But the fans certainly didn't expect anything out of us. And even the broadcasters and the writers didn't expect much out of us, although they occasionally got caught up in a press release that suggested we really had a good team. But then they float back down to reality and realize that we didn't have a good team, we couldn't possibly have a good team because we were made up of guys nobody else wanted. And there are parts on the players. A, we were happy to still be in baseball. B, it was interesting meeting guys from other teams. And from an author's point of view, it was the best of all worlds.
It was a gold mine.
It was a gold mine. I got all the great storytellers from all the teams. So I could get all the Oakland Athletics stories from John Donahue, all the Cleveland Indian and Boston Red Sox stories from Gary Bell, all the Minnesota Twins stories from Don Mincher, you know, all the White Sox stories from Talbot, the Detroit Tigers stories from Ray Orler. I mean, here were representatives from all these different teams coming together. And so the whole summer was telling stories. Because guys were, it's like we were sitting around the campfire telling all these stories. And so it was a wonderful, it was a gold mine. It's absolutely right. It's perfect.
Serendipity for you.
Oh, yes, it was marvelous. It was such a great, and then to get sent down to the minor leagues early in the season. And then to come, what it's like to get sent down, what it's like to get pulled up, how much fun that is. And then get traded to another league and a team in a pennant race, suddenly I'm in a pennant race. I mean, it was just magical. I couldn't have been on better teams that year to write a book.
And then Bowie Kuhn helped you promote it.
And then Bowie Kuhn helped me promote it. I mean, what more could you ask?
Could you have done it without him?
I don't know. Maybe Dick Young could have done it all by himself. But the two of them made a great combination, I'll tell you that.
With enemies like that, he needs friends, right?
That's exactly right.
Being on an expansion team was more of an opportunity than an exile, right? Even though, in a way, you guys were exiles.
Yeah. Yeah, but we were... It was an opportunity for everybody. For kids, it was a chance to, you know, for young guys, it was a chance to play in the big leagues, and there were two new teams. Without those two new teams, some of those guys might have had to wait another year or two before they got their shot. And for other guys, it was the difference between, you know, getting released or not.
I read a quote recently. Johnny Oates was talking about his regret during his career was that as a marginal player, he was always so worried about whether he was going to get cut or traded or sent down. He wasn't able to enjoy the game. What enabled you to avoid that downfall?
I think what enabled me to enjoy it all the time was the fact that I never felt I belonged in the big leagues in the first place. I didn't think I was going to ever get there. It was beyond dreaming when I was a kid. I was too little when I was a kid. I didn't think I'd ever be big enough to be a big league ball player. I didn't know anybody that played in the big leagues. Nobody in my town ever played minor league baseball, but I knew that. I mean, the big hero in town when I was in high school was a guy named Bill Shute. And he played double-A baseball. And he was like the town hero. So the idea, he was 6'4". The idea that I would actually play in the big leagues was out of the question. It never crossed my mind until I got... actually signed a minor league contract, and I said, hey, maybe I can make it. But, so when I finally got to the big leagues, it was like, this was like a magical wonder then. I didn't know how long it would last, but it didn't matter. If it lasted a day, it was great. If it lasted a week, it was great. So I never saw it as a career. I always thought it was just a wonderful thing that had happened to me for a period of my life, and when it's all over, then I'll go do something else. And I'll be glad for every year I have.
But I have a feeling that you're looking forward to playing in that 75 and over league someday.
Well, I play in a league here in New Jersey called the Metropolitan League. No age limit, so I'm playing with kids who are 22 years old.
Right, well, I wrote to you. I saw you pitch at Riverdale when I was home on a college vacation.
Yeah. So I'm fairly competitive in the league.
All right. How are you doing this year?
Fair. I'm like 4-7, but my team is 10 games under 500, so I'm probably a little above average in the league as a pitcher.
You throw exclusively the knuckler?
No, I mix in a very weak sinker and a changeup, which is a changeup off of nothing.
A changeup off the knuckleball. That's like a straight pitch, just a straight slow pitch instead of a wobbly slow pitch.
Right. It's straight and slow versus wobbly and slow. But it's a very big motion. I feel it's a huge motion. Looks like maybe this time he is throwing a fastball. Nope.
Not this time either.
Not this time either.
They
keep thinking with that kind of emotion, it's got to be faster than this. No, it isn't. It isn't the fast.
You know, I don't know if you saw the Mets game last night that I went to. They have this 6'10 guy they brought up from AAA to pitch the game. And I think the Pirates were expecting a Randy Johnson, a guy that big, he's got to fire the ball. And he threw a lot of sliders and sinkers and threw strikes, and they hit ground balls all night. And he only had one real threat to score off him because I think of that expectation.
Yeah.
Because he's so big, he must be ready to fire the ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's what pitching's all about, right?
Sure, yeah. Throwing it at a speed and in a location that the batter doesn't expect. They pop them up in batting practice once in a while.
I saw that once, yeah. Ah, let's see. That's probably all the questions I had written down. So, I'll turn the tape off. I want to tell you about this novel I'm writing, because I think you'll...
Have you read The Penman?